now, America's number one show on pop culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. It's a great day to celebrate legal argument, which is at the very essence of our being as a nation and a nation of law and a nation of laws. But it's not every day that you get a distinguished legal scholar who says that a decision by one of our highest courts, not the Supreme Court, but the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals, that a decision that they make is bonkers. But I think Ed Whalen is right on this. Ed Whalen is the distinguished senior fellow and Antonin Scalia Chair in Constitutional Studies at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. And he's also a frequent writer for National Review and other publications. And he has written a piece about a case that you probably haven't heard about yet. But you will, because I am not sure that the Supreme Court can avoid taking up this case. The case is called LLC 303 Creative LLC versus Alenis. And it's all about not a wedding cake this time. No, it's not pastry. This is a website. Now, you'd think, wouldn't you, Mr. Whalen, wouldn't you think that a website would be the very essence of protected free speech, something that you're deciding to post and design for other people to be posted on the internet?
Yes, indeed, and that's what the Tenth Circuit majority, in fact, started with. It recognized that what we're talking about here was pure speech, creation of wedding websites. And what's most nefarious about this opinion is that it actually expresses the First Amendment speech interest in the strongest possible form, but then finds that they're somehow defeated by the supposed governmental interest. And, you know, the amazing thing is the court basically says that, and pardon the legal jargon here, but it's applying the highest standard of strict scrutiny and says that this law that would require that this website designer offer wedding websites that would celebrate same-sex marriages, if she's going to offer wedding marriages, is narrowly tailored. In other words, there's no other way to serve Colorado's interest in ensuring that marginalized groups have access to the commercial marketplace. And the trick here, which is, I can't believe there are three people in the country who could who would buy into this argument, is that this website designer's skills are supposedly so unique that you can't get the services from anyone else. Well, there are thousands of website providers out there. The market is robust to provide alternatives. And the notion that we're going to say that the very fact that this person has her own creativity means that she can be conscripted to provide services for those whose message she opposes just has everything entirely backwards. And I can't imagine the Supreme Court, if it addresses this issue, would let this stand. I think it'd be a 9-0 slam on that particular issue.
Well, it's a divided court this time, and on the lower level, on the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals level. We've had Jack Phillips on the show a couple of times, who has, of course, become world famous as the baker in Colorado, who didn't decline to serve gay customers. He declined to do a gay-themed wedding cake. Now, there's no accusation here in this case that the defendant or the appellant who actually did not want to be cited and busted by the state, that she was declining to serve people who were gay. It was just she didn't want to follow a certain theme, which was pro-gay marriage, which I take it she is not.
Oh, that's exactly right. The majority in the case acknowledges that she will serve gay customers on all sorts of matters. That what she objects to is celebrating same-sex marriage, and that's true whether the customer requesting the celebration is a same-sex couple or is someone else, a straight person who wants to celebrate the same-sex marriage. So, yeah, with Jack Phillips' case, you know, there's the complication that a lot of people don't see baking a cake or decorating a cake. The artistic element and the relation to the First Amendment is more complicated there than it is in this case, where, again, the majority recognizes that we're dealing with pure speech, yet somehow finds that the state can compel speech that the person strongly opposes on religious grounds.
Okay, so literally, how does this work right now? Has she been assessed a fine, or does she risk the loss of her entire business for the designer who declined to design a website celebrating a specific gay marriage? And it was a specific gay marriage, right? It wasn't gay marriage in general.
Well, no, the posture here is complicated in that it's very different from Jack Phillips, in that she anticipated the problem that she would face. And she sued the members of the Colorado Civil Rights Commission out of fear that they would penalize her. So she actually hasn't even started up her website. You know, this website that's supposedly, in the majority's view, is so unique that everyone has to have access to it, doesn't even exist yet, which makes all the more laughable the notion that there aren't alternatives available.
Let me read you part of this decision, because it is hilarious. You say, I think that this is the most stupid analysis of competition that I have ever read. You say, your commentary. And here's the analysis that's the most stupid you've ever read. And I think you're right. This case does not present a competitive market. Rather, due to the unique nature of appellant services, this case is more similar to a monopoly. The product at issue is not merely custom-made wedding websites, but rather custom-made wedding websites of the same quality and nature as those made by appellants. In that market, only appellants exist. In other words, she's the only one with her own level of skill and creativity to create a wedding website? The only one in Colorado? Only one in the country, in the world?
Only one in the world. I mean, this is a service you can get worldwide. Panel majority's error here is they would apply the same analysis, say, to a photographer who would take family pictures. And they would say, well, photographer, you advertise on your website that you do custom photography. That means that you are unique. That means that no one else can do what you do. That means that you are the only market for this, and that means that we need to conscript you to serve whomever we think you ought to serve, and to create whatever photography we think you ought to create, whether you object to that or not. That's the logic of this. It's brain dead crazy.
What happens next? They have to get the Supreme Court to agree to take it up, and they can do that with just four justices, right?
That's right. I mean, it's possible that they'll first seek to have the full Tenth Circuit revisit this decision. I don't know that that's a sensible step given the composition of the Tenth Circuit. I think it's more likely that they would go to the Supreme Court and try to get cert granted. Whether there are procedural complications here, I don't know. It's rather unusual to be able to get the sort of review in advance that the designer sought and received. You know, there's this question of legal standing that the panel majority first had to rule on. But I just, for all my differences with the some of the liberal justices on the court, I just cannot imagine that there is a single justice who would do anything other than laugh at the Tenth Circuit's reasoning.
Well, we will continue covering this. Ed Whalen, I greatly appreciate your perspective. His piece about the only website in the world on that exalted level that it's a monopoly, that piece is posted at michaelmedved.com. When we come back, a conservative voice, conservative for helping relieve traffic and improve access here in Washington. Coming up.
This is the Michael Medved Show. MichaelMedved.com. You're listening to a best of the Michael Medved Show.
On the Michael Medved Show, Chuck Schumer took the floor of the Senate. He didn't use the opportunity to bash Republicans or conservatives or people who were blocking the Biden agenda. What the majority leader of the Senate did was he actually praised Republicans and some Democrats for managing to work together. Here is the comment from the majority leader. It's clip one.
I want to commend the group of senators, the group of who worked with President Biden to reach an agreement on a bipartisan infrastructure bill. The Senate has just come together and in a strong bipartisan fashion voted to begin the legislative process here on the Senate floor. For the past few months, I have laid out a two-track strategy on infrastructure, a bipartisan bill focused on traditional brick-and-mortar infrastructure projects, and a budget reconciliation bill where Democrats plan to make historic investments in American jobs, American families, and efforts to fight climate change. In order to start work on the on a reconciliation bill, the Senate must pass a budget resolution first. As I've said repeatedly, our goal was to pass both bills in this session, hopefully in July. My goal remains to pass both bipartisan My goal remains to pass both the bipartisan infrastructure bill and a budget resolution during this work period. Both. It might take some long nights. It might eat into our weekends. But we are going to get the job done, and we are on track.
That's a hopeful declaration. We shall see. I think that one of the things that Republicans are counting on is that if they do pass the bipartisan bill, that there will be enough sane, moderate Democrats to either cut back or block altogether what they call the reconciliation bill, the one that could pass with just 50 votes in the Senate. And remember, one senator, Kyrsten Sinema, or Mark Warner, who's expressed some doubts about it, the senator from Virginia, or Joe Manchin, of course, senator from West Virginia, any one of them could block that so-called reconciliation bill that Schumer is talking about that would add about $3 trillion to the price tag at a time when people are rightly worried about the impact on inflation on the economy generally. But Pete Buttigieg, the Secretary of Transportation, who would be one of the big beneficiaries of the money spigot that would be turned on if either bill passed, certainly both of them passed, he actually also spoke with a note of optimism. This is a transportation secretary.
So what you have in this bill is that historic general investment that the president has been talking about. We're talking about the biggest dedicated investment in bridges since the Eisenhower administration when they set up the interstate highway system in the first place. We're talking about the biggest investment in public transit that we've ever done as a country, the most for passenger rail since Amtrak was set up. It's got funding to get lead out of the pipes that take drinking water to our kids, funding to get Americans connected to broadband, so many things that are so long overdue. And I think it's extraordinary in today's Washington to see, frankly, Democratic and Republican senators agreeing on much of anything, let alone a major area of domestic policy. But that's what this deal represents. And this is a big step toward getting it turned into law, signed by the president, and enacted so that agencies across the administration, including mine, can start deploying those dollars and getting them out to the communities that need them.
Okay, we shall see. There will be developments at some point, very dramatically, I'm sure, as far as the infrastructure bill is concerned. The Biden administration has announced that they're going to make important announcements about new initiatives about battling COVID, because that, of course, is something that could block anything else or any progress on the economy or where we stand. Senator Elizabeth Warren is not one of those senators who is concerned at all about the level of spending. She wants Joe Biden to pick up his pen and do what? This is the senator declaring her desire for presidential initiative. It's clip 10.
Oh, we're here today to say, tick tock, tick tock, Mr. President. Millions of Americans ask you now to pick up a pen and cancel student loan debt. To pick up a pen and extend the payment pause. To pick up a pen and make their lives better.
Okay, fortunately, not even every liberal Democrat is ready to pick up a pen and have the president do that, cancel all student debt. And in fact, Speaker Pelosi at her press conference today said something about that Elizabeth Warren initiative. This is clip 6.
People think that the president of the United States has the power for debt forgiveness. He does not. He can postpone, he can delay, but he does not have that power. That has to be an act of Congress. I don't even like to call it forgiveness because that implies a transgression. It's not to be forgiven. Just freeing people from those obligations. The question of who gets forgiven, to use the term of art that is out there, is a debate. Do we use whatever money there is for the broadest base of support of those with more people with even less debt or fewer people with more debt? That's a policy discussion. But the difference between the president can't do it. So that's not even a discussion. Not everybody realizes that, but the president can only postpone, delay, but not forgive.
Okay, and she's right on that, by the way. And at least one Democrat wants to restrain that idea that, because you're talking about, in terms of forgiving all student loan debt, I believe they're talking about close to $1 trillion again. And part of this, I think, is creating the idea that nobody knows what's happening next or what the president can or will or not. And there's no clear agenda beyond trying to get the infrastructure bill done. And it is one of the problems that, as Daniel Henninger said, we were citing it before, is causing the Biden administration and Joe Biden's leadership to lose altitude. One of the other issues is, will the infrastructure bill change everything in terms of traffic congestion and public transit here in the state of Washington? Where, of course, things are being handled horribly. But we'll find out why from the Washington Policy Center with some new hope for getting out of traffic coming up on The Medved Show.
You're listening to a best of The Michael Medved Show. If you missed anything in today's broadcast, or if you want to check out our show archives, which go back over 5 years, consider becoming a MedHead now at michaelmedved.com. Go to michaelmedved.com, click the MedHead banner, and subscribe. We got some special deals going on right now. The cost of becoming a MedHead subscriber? About the price of a latte per month.
And on the Michael Medved Show, the head of the Washington Policy Center's Cole Center for Transportation is Maria Frost, and she joins us after writing two provocative blogs about the state of transportation. Before we get to that, Maria, there's a lot of talk right now, of course, it's huge news, about the infrastructure bill. What all of that appears to argue, and this is very directly related to what's going on in the state of Washington, what's going on here before, is that the best way to relieve traffic is to invest in more and more public transportation, like our light rail system here. Does any scientific research or actual experience indicate that that is the case, that building more train tracks and more train lines for urban transportation is a great way to clear the freeways. Has that worked here?
No, it hasn't. And in fact, we had Wendell Cox, who is a national transportation expert, take a look at transportation in the Puget Sound, and he found his key finding was that there is no potential at any cost for transit to materially reduce driving or to reduce traffic congestion in the Puget Sound.
Okay. Is that, do you think, unique to where we live somehow? Or that's kind of been true across the country, hasn't it? That places like San Francisco Bay that have invested tremendous trillions of dollars in money building trains have some of the worst traffic in the country, no?
That's absolutely right. You know, transit really serves a very niche market in the downtown core. So in Seattle, you've got about a 48% of the commuting to downtown taken on transit. But outside of that downtown core for the rest of the city of Seattle, it drops down from 48% to 9.3% for the rest of the city of Seattle. And then if you go out to the rest of the Puget Sound, transit use for commuting purposes drops down to 3.5% percent of work trips. And so the majority of people in the Puget Sound region drive, and that includes to the city of downtown, excluding the downtown core.
Which is extraordinary. So we're talking about 96%+ who choose to drive and don't use the light rail. What's the running tab on the light rails so far?
For all of Sound Transit's extensions, right now we're looking at about $130 billion.
Yeah,
it was about
million.
92, and now it's 130 with the last financial projections that I've seen from Sound Transit.
Okay, one of the things that you write about in a new blog that people should go to, we've posted it at our website at michaelmedved.com, and the Washington Policy Center is, honest to goodness, the best source for reliable information on this issue. One of the things you write about is how, a relieving traffic congestion is the best way to improve access to jobs. But what's the best way to relieve traffic congestion?
Well, there's a number of ways to do that. And I point out in the blog, and I say this often, that there's no single silver bullet to fixing mobility. It really has to be a number of different things working together, which includes, yes, capacity increases where there are bottlenecks, but it also includes, supporting telework for those for whom it works. It includes encouraging transit agencies to innovate and modernize how they provide service so that they can be efficient too. There are a number of different pieces that have to all work together, but the problem with transportation policy in Washington State is that capacity improvements have largely been dismissed, and the State Department of Transportation has shifted to, supporting transit and tolling, traffic demand management, managing congestion rather than relieving congestion, and really shifting away from providing people with the relief that they pay for. And that's a problem.
This is important perspective for people to gain. And it's posted at michaelmedved.com from Washington Policy Center. You have another blog about how state officials have come clean about making decisions based on ideology and not data. Where'd they do this?
So the State Department of Transportation Secretary Roger Millar said that the department is shifting away from a data-focused approach to a values-based, data-informed approach, because he says data doesn't make decisions, models don't make decisions, people make decisions. I think part of the reason that they're shifting away from a data-based approach is because the data highlights their failure. We see that at both the Department of Transportation and also Todd Myers pointed out with Results Washington and failure to meet CO2 targets and shifting to narrative-based approaches where we largely disregard the data and shift to, talking about social justice and things like that, which is totally disconnected from what I think the Department of Transportation's core function is or should be.
The new infrastructure bill that seems likely to pass says they're going to offer $110 billion for roads. and $66 billion for passenger and freight rail. Does that ratio sound sane to you in any universe that you know?
No, but I'm not surprised either, and it's something I'm going to be looking at more closely, because right now there is a real push at the federal level and also the state level to shift the kind of the ratio between how much of your money goes to roads and how much of it goes to transit. So traditionally, and this is very generally speaking, at the federal level, about 80% of your federal gas tax goes to roads and 20% goes to transit. And there are officials like Congressman DeFazio who are looking to make that a more even split, a more 50-50 split, and in other words, getting more money for public transit all across the country, which doesn't make any sense. It didn't make sense before COVID, and it certainly doesn't make sense now.
Wouldn't that, in a city or region like ours, mean that a disproportionate amount of the benefit would go to people who live in the city core as opposed to people who live in some outlying suburbs or rural areas?
Yeah, I mean, I would imagine that urban planners would talk about improving service and adding stations in certain places, but just because there's a station somewhere doesn't mean that people are going to use it, right? Which is why I think it's so important to get away from talking about access to a mode and instead start talking about access to employment, right? And so that, regardless of mode.
Well, it's such an important point. Now, again, people can read about it at Washington Policy Center. Amaria Frost, it is always a pleasure to hear your perspective. And I'm sure you're going to be there at a grand occasion that is coming up October 1st. And it features one of the most outspoken and, frankly, inspiring advocates for the capitalist system, who is called, in fact, capitalism the greatest thing humanity has ever accomplished. Well, he's accomplished a great deal. John Mackey, who is an internationally acclaimed CEO and a free market champion. He will be the keynote speaker at the Washington Policy Center annual dinner, which is coming up in Bellevue at the Hyatt Regency. Yes, in person, in Bellevue, at the Hyatt Regency. That's coming up on October 1st. Tickets and information are available at WPCdinner.com. That's WPCdinner.com. This is always every year. It's one of the most important gathering places for pro-free market people, for conservatives, for moderates, for people who want an alternative to some of the extremism that we see in Seattle and, unfortunately, in Olympia. Check it out. There's a big green banner at our website for all Washington Policy Center information. When we come back, another billionaire, very successful advocate for free markets, takes on Senator Warren in a fiery televised clash. Over what? About heavier taxes on wealth. That and more coming up on The Medved Show.
Become a Medhead and receive 50% off History Store downloads for all annual members. Join today at michaelmedved.com.
You're listening to a best of the Michael Medved Show.
On the Michael Medved Show, one of the most controversial elements of the Biden agenda involves raising of taxes. And one of the things that he has not signed on for is a proposition that always polls very well. Democrats seem to like the idea overwhelmingly, and there are even some Republicans who do, of a wealth tax. That, of course, was popularized by Elizabeth Warren back during her failed presidential campaign. And remember, we played a segment on the show where it says she even dreams at night about a wealth tax. What would a wealth tax do? A wealth tax would take away money that people have worked a lifetime to accumulate. For one thing, it would be incredibly rough on older people, because the older people have paid taxes all their lives, and then all of a sudden, you're supposed to start coughing up a chunk of it if you've earned enough. And billionaire Ken Langone, who is one of those people who was involved with Home Depot, I believe, at one point, in forming and organizing Home Depot with Bernie Marcus. He goes off after Senator Warren in a CNBC clash that has gone viral. And here is what Ken Langone has to say about his own personal relationship, and he would be a major target because he's a wealthy man, what he says about his own personal relationship to the wealth tax idea. This is clip 6A.
A wealth tax is negative compound interest. What it is. You're right. I made all the money. I paid the government what I owed them. What I had left, I put at risk. I could have lost it all. I could have lost it all. But I paid my share. I have a bigger issue for the senator that I think I would hope she would address that to me is apple pie and motherhood. Senator.
Could we talk about the wealth tax just for a minute before we change subjects here?
Senator, I have an easy one for you, and you're going to be shocked that I'm bringing it up from a fat cat Wall Street guy. How do you rationalize giving me $3,000 a month check every month? With all my wealth, why don't you people have the courage to address entitlements as to what should no longer be an entitlement? I shouldn't get Social Security.
Wow. Now, is Elizabeth Warren going to give any meaningful answer on that? And again, this goes for Warren Buffett. It goes for a bunch of the wealthiest people in the country, not for Jeff Bezos or Bill Gates, because they're not old enough yet to qualify for Social Security. But yes, Ken Langone does, Bernie Marcus does, and these are people who hold billions of dollars and get a check every single month that comes in like clockwork, which many Americans depend on. They don't. And he's dared to ask the uncomfortable question. Here's Senator Warren, clip 6B.
It's structured as an insurance policy. And you paid in year after year, year after year. And part of the contract was if you would pay in, you would get this kind of return on the back end. It's not somebody's welfare. It's not somebody's charity. Mm-hmm. It was an agreement that every employee in the country who is eligible for Social Security paid into and gets a return at the back end. Surely you wouldn't want to be the person who would go on national TV and say, after a contract has been negotiated and someone has paid into it for 40 years, that the federal government should turn around and say, oops, we changed our mind. We're not going to give you the payout that you earned by making those payments all those years.
And Ken Langone's answer is basically his main point is not that rich people should be denied their Social Security. His main point is, and which he makes very forcefully and very well, is that, okay, once you've, say you paid in to a contract, you've also had a contract in terms you're going to pay taxes at a certain rate, and you're going to pay taxes on all of the money that you've earned and that your investments have earned, and then on top of that, they're going to go after the money that you've saved. One of the problems with this entire approach is it gives elderly people who would be subjected to this kind of wealth tax, where the more money you save, the more taxes you pay. And yes, she claims that it would only be 2%, I believe, on people who have earned more than $1 million, and 3% on people who have earned and saved and accumulated more than $1 million, and people who have earned and saved and more than $1 billion, it would be 3%. But the point is that if you live for a certain time and you're paying that every year, it is, as he says, compounded. And again, the idea of this exchange that they go through also lacks any sort of recognition for the fact that a guy like Ken Langone has actually created literally millions of jobs, and probably over the course of his lifetime when you count the taxes that are also assessed on those jobs that he has provided and his own taxes and his company's taxes, it provides him with the government with literally billions in taxes, certainly many millions.
Now it's time for Medved's Entertainment Minute.
Clint Eastwood plays an aging rodeo star who accepts an odd assignment to reunite one of his longtime bosses with his teenage Mexican son, which leads to a dramatic, sometimes dangerous journey in Cry Macho, now in theaters and streaming on HBO Max.
You get too angry. It's not good for you. You used to be strong, macho.
I used to be a lot of things, but I'm not now.
Well, Eastwood still is a skillful actor, director, and producer. But the movie, sentimental and touching as it is at points, seems more manipulative than magnificent, with a romantic subplot that makes little sense. Eastwood is one of Hollywood's all-time greats, so even though this adaptation of a novel from 1975 seems occasionally tired and tiresome, it's still entirely watchable. 2.5 stars for Cry Macho, rated PG-13.
This feature brought to you by the Thank Heaven Foundation.
There is a huge piece in the New York Times, and we have to get to it and spend some time on it because it basically looks like a very optimistic headline. But I don't think it's optimistic for those of us who actually believe in a free market capitalist system. It says, temporary relief in pandemic pushes poverty to record low. And there is a real difference, which this piece never recognizes, between poverty, which involves the inability to make money or to earn money, and being short on cash. And basically, they begin by saying the huge increase in government aid prompted by the coronavirus pandemic will cut poverty nearly in half this year from pre-pandemic levels and push the share of Americans in poverty to the lowest level on record, according to the most comprehensive analysis yet of a vast but temporary expansion of the safety net. Of course, what they're trying to say is that we have to replace the safety net and its temporary nature with a permanent entitlement. And some of these figures here are utterly staggering. And the question is it possible meaningfully to end poverty just by spending government money? Aren't there literally scores of failed socialist, quote, experiments that indicate that that doesn't work? We will get to that. We'll also get to the right way to prepare people for academic success and to close racial gaps in academic performance. That coming up with the one and only Ian Rowe and more in This Greatest Nation on God's Green Earth. This is Michael Medved at michaelmedved.com for Town Hall. The current anguish over racial justice has been punctuated by intensifying demands for monetary reparations to the descendants of enslaved Americans. The prospect of arranging appropriate compensation for uncompensated slave labor that ended 155 years ago remains wildly impractical, but it also goes against the nation's highest ideals. America has always been the land of fresh starts and new life, where you're not judged by who your grandparents were or where they came from. To the greatest extent possible, your progress in life should reflect your own efforts, not your family's past. Slavery reparations emphasize the opposite idea, assigning tax-funded payouts based not on who you are, but on who your great-great-grandparents were. Joe Biden has already expressed support for a commission to evaluate slavery reparations. If this ill-advised effort becomes a major issue, the American people will rightly reject a program designed to accentuate, not narrow, racial differences.